This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that lets you accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit and debit cards in your mobile app or website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/wired news. Coming up today, Radiohead make peace with Spotify, another bad week for website security, and we try and get our heads around the latest brain-melting discoveries about black holes. You are listening to episode 271 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business, and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Vicky Wollaston.
Hello.
And Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
A thing you have learned this week. Let's start with Vicky.
Now, this is a fact that may make many of us feel old. It does make me feel old. Tetris celebrated its 30th birthday this week. Happy birthday, Tetris. Despite breaking the world record for being ported onto a staggering 65 platforms, its creator, Alexey Pachinov, reportedly made no money from the game until he gave the rights to the Soviet government in the late 1980s.
Whoops. The biggest video game of all time, potentially.
Yes.
It's like the Bible of video games. Matt Reynolds.
Very different vibe with this one. So I found out this week that any animal that weighs more than 2.2 kilos will take the same amount of time to empty their full bladder. So, you know, any animal, from a domestic cat, tiny, to elephants, really big, they take about 20 seconds to have a wee. What's really cool about this is that a full bladder on an elephant holds 190 litres of water. That's like a bar full of water. And it's gone, you know, racing a cat and it, you know, same amount of time.
So an elephant and a cat would pee in exactly the same amount of time.
They could go together to the toilet and they'd pop out again and they'd be like, oh, hi, yeah, we both just, you know, had a wee.
Except the cat might get a bit gross and wet. Anyway, I learned this week that the looting of archaeological sites goes back quite a bit further than you might think. So it's been in the headlines a lot, of course, because of the rise of ISIS. But when do you think the first known trial of looters in Egypt took place?
Ooh, I'm gonna go with fairly early. I'm gonna say like 1712
BC or AD.
Now I've realized that ancient Egypt existed, so I'm gonna go for 1000 BC.
Very good, Vicky.
I actually think that Matt Reynolds might be onto something there, so I might just say 1010 BC.
By being that kind of person, you've won. It's 1113 BC. A gang raided a rock tomb, but were caught and convicted, probably death by impalement.
Nasty.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about, aside from the horrors of ISIS, about the raiding of archaeological sites at the moment, is it actually predates the collapse of governments and countries around that area by a couple of years. And it's actually linked to people's wages going down and the price of fuel going up. So most people couldn't get enough money together, so they just went and looted a bit on the side. So the rise of looting is actually a little bit earlier than most people think.
Wow.
Bonus fact. Matt Reynolds, this week, Wired published its first feature-length documentary. We went to Shenzhen. Tell us some more.
Absolutely. So the first in Wired's Future Cities documentary series, and we went to Shenzhen, which is in China, to see what was happening there. Now, Shenzhen is a huge city. It's got a population that's probably as high as 20 million. No one's really sure. And it produces a phenomenal amount of tech hardware. You know, there's a really, really high chance that the smartphone you're holding right now, it was manufactured in Shenzhen. Foxconn is, which makes Apple phones, is headquartered right there.
So I'm going to stop you right there, and we're going to take a quick listen to an excerpt of the documentary.
The image the West has of Shenzhen, a decade ago when I first came, it was very skewed, right? It was like Shenzhen is Foxconn, there's child labor, people throw themselves off buildings, they only make iPhones. They'll just sort of dismiss it and say, yeah, I know Shenzhen, I read about that in the book. That's just not the case. There's so much to offer, and the cool thing is that in this particular city, everything revolves around electronics and tech and building hardware.
what's really exciting about Shenzhen is that it attracts really brilliant global hardware startups because of how easy and quick it is to prototype products there. So Wired visited the Hacks Hardware Accelerator, and we found out that one startup in particular, Rovenzo, who basically make robot rovers that can go and decommission nuclear power plants from inside. They're really cool. They smash up things and they're really interesting. And the CEO of that startup told us that what it takes a couple of hours to find in Shenzhen can take like weeks to source from elsewhere in the world. So really, if you want to be in the heart of the hardware world, that's where it is.
So it's a bit like everyone seemingly that wants to start a startup will go to one of these hubs. They'll go to London or Berlin or Tel Aviv or San Francisco, Silicon Valley obviously being the big example of that. But I suppose if you're involved in rapid hardware innovation, then you need to be near the factories that make that hardware. And that's what's happened in Shenzhen over the last couple of decades. It's gone from, this is the famous story, it was a tiny fishing village with just a few thousand people. Then the Chinese government introduced these financial incentives for stuff to happen there, and kaboom, you have a city of 10, 15 million people in the blink of an eye, which is incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that in the West, typically, when we think of places like this and we think of Chinese hardware hubs, we think of knockoff iPhones, we think of production lines that are just pushing out, you know, copycat smartphones. And that is so true on one level. You know, go to Shenzhen and you can get 5,000 fake iPhones branded with your company logo like that. You know, they're ready to go. They sell empty iPhone boxes. They stack them, you know, as high as the ceilings because they're ready to push these out. But what's actually really interesting about this, and the documentary really digs inside this, is that the spirit and approach towards intellectual property in China and in Shenzhen particularly is really different. So the Chinese have a specific word for making copycat products. They call it Shanzai. And that's all about a kind of way of working that's open, it's collaborative, it's sharing knowledge, it's saying, oh, I make LED lights. Yeah, I make bikes. Let's put your LEDs on my bike and I'm going to make it play MP3s as well because why not?
Yeah. And there's a couple of really amazing scenes in the documentary. It's 15 minutes, well worth your time. Go and check it out, wired.co.uk/video, where we're walking around a market in Shenzhen and there's all of these people frantically putting stuff together. And the person guiding us around explains that, okay, so you go to Shenzhen and you need your phone repaired. And maybe it will be a case of the battery needs replacing, the screen's a bit bust, etc., etc. There are various things wrong with your handset. So you give it to someone. And they say, come back in 20 minutes. And it will fly around this market. And loads of different people working for loads of different companies will work on this phone. And then they'll all collaborate. Someone will dole out the money in a fair share at the end of it. And you'll pay one person and get your phone back fixed. Which is kind of clever.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about, it's kind of like an ecosystem that revolves around really individually specialized, but very well connected and very fast working individuals. That means that these things really turn around really quickly. It's a completely different way of working than we have over here.
Yeah, and there's another, and this completely blew my mind. So you think of shucking oysters or maybe shucking corn in a field. In Shenzhen, you shuck mobile phones. So there's this bit of footage of a couple of people sitting on some concrete steps and they're smacking phones against the edge of the step and taking out all the valuable parts and putting them in one bucket and throwing all the stuff away into another bucket. So they're shucking phones for valuable parts. It's just, it's remarkable. It's almost like, how can that exist? But of course it does, because the phone might be redundant, but the technology inside it is still perfectly good.
Yeah, maybe that's, you know, in one of those hoverboards now, and you'll see that, you know, jetting down a street of London. Now, who knows where those things end up? But Shenzhen is a place that is all about, you know, recycling stuff. Nothing goes to waste. If it can be used, we'll repurpose it and build something new out of it.
Yep, and this is the first of how many episodes that we're going to do on Shenzhen?
So there's 4 episodes.
So it's an hour-long documentary.
That's right,
and they're
yep.
going to be coming out once a week for the next 3 weeks.
Exactly.
Check them all out, wired.co.uk/video. From video to audio, this week Radiohead made a rather rapid change of heart, seemingly, and have decided to release their latest album on Spotify, which might sound surprising to some people that remember the passwords of Radiohead frontman Tom York when he described Spotify as the desperate fart of a dying corpse. Words that he might now want to reconsider. So Radiohead's new album, A Moon-Shaped Pool, came out at the start of May on Tidal and Apple Music. but only two songs were put on Spotify. That's all about to change on June 17th. It will be released in full on Spotify, the same day as the album is released physically on those pesky things called CDs, and I presume vinyl as well. But this is part of a really long-running feud between, seemingly, Radiohead and Spotify and streaming services in general. Vicky, do you remember this kind of story from a couple of years ago when it started to happen and Radiohead's dislike for Spotify?
Oh yeah, totally. And it's it was the air. So at that point, Spotify was nowhere near the behemoth that it is now. And I think a lot of people thought, not that they thought it would not go anywhere. Obviously, Spotify is very valuable to a lot of people, but I think they thought that maybe it wouldn't be as big as it's ended up being.
Yeah.
And I think it. I mean, it even reared its this whole debate ugly head with Apple Music and Taylor Swift. So I think a lot of artists are now going, look, having that tangible product in your hand, having a CD and a vinyl, they really want to stick to that. And let's be honest, a lot of these musicians got into music because of growing up themselves with these products. And so having a download doesn't quite feel the same. But I think that technology moves on and they're just going to have to move on with it. Otherwise, they're going to miss out on a fan base that they might not have otherwise.
Yeah, so in 2013, when Radiohead pulled all of their back catalogue from Spotify, this was around the time that Thom Yorke made the dying fart corpse comment. It was also around the time that another musical endeavour that Thom Yorke was involved in called Atoms for Peace, along with Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, their album was also pulled. All of Radiohead's back catalogue, apart from In Rainbows, is now back on Spotify, as is Atoms for Peace's album. But at the time, Radiohead producer Nigel Godrich, this was back in 2013, said, and I'm not going to quite quote him word for word because he's a bit rude, the reason that new artists get paid squat all with this model, it's an equation that just doesn't work. And York followed up on Twitter by saying, make no mistake, new artists you discover on Spotify will not get paid. Meanwhile, shareholders will shortly be rolling in it. He made a typo, but that's what he meant. And it's interesting because it's a debate that won't go away. The difference between how much an artist might make from gigs or selling physical music and Spotify is really, really difficult, particularly when you look at how many people actually pay for Spotify. So it's 30 million people a month pay to use Spotify out of around 100 million monthly active users. So less than half. And the difference in money that Spotify gives out from free tracks and premium tracks is really different. And that's a big problem. But seems to be one that Radiohead are now willing to bend to. So I think some of their most popular tracks have over 100 million streams on Spotify, which makes them a really, really popular band. And at that kind of volume, you do make money from these streaming services. But there still seems to be this problem, right, between really big bands on Spotify and smaller bands. How do you get discovered on there? Do either of you use it?
Yeah, I do use Spotify, so I don't pay for Spotify.
Why don't you pay for Spotify?
Because I just think that, honestly, I find it quite difficult to organise music on Spotify. I'm so old-fashioned. I really love holding a CD and being like, great, I'll start a track one, and we'll go through to track 11, and then that's it. And
do you never put it on shuffle?
What, a CD? No. I mean, really, that idea, it shocks me. I still have an iPod Classic. I've had that about 10 years and I love it more than life itself, so to me that feels advanced. So I do use Spotify occasionally where I'm thinking, oh, you know, what kind of new stuff, you know, what's out there, what's my Discover Weekly. But yeah, I think I am a bit of a old-fashioned one when it comes to that.
Vicky?
You see, I am a huge Drake fan.
Okay.
And most of Drake's back catalogue is on Spotify. Mm-hmm. But when his new album Views came out, it wasn't made available on Spotify straight away. So I bought it from Apple Music. So now obviously it is available on Spotify. So in that respect, Drake, obviously he already had a following anyway. But say, for example, you're a smaller band, you go on Spotify, you put your tracks out there, you develop this fan base. You then do that same sort of model with what Drake did, is that later on you go, we've just released a new album, we're only going to make it available to buy for like 3 or 4 weeks. If you're a really diehard fan and you want it straight away, you'll pay for it. If you're not, then obviously they'll go back to Spotify. But it's then shifting people from introducing someone on streaming and then being able to shift them towards this paid model seems to be where it's going.
Yeah, and you see it with, to go back to the example of Radiohead, so I think it was in Rainbows you could buy a £40 special edition of the album with beautiful artwork and accompanying material, and it was, you know, a really premium product, as opposed to Spotify, which on the free model can be a bit lousy. So Spotify on when you don't pay for it, if you don't know, doesn't let you listen to songs in order, doesn't let you pick specific songs, doesn't let you stream just one album. You just have an option to shuffle play on an artist, so that gives you a really, really limited way of listening to music, which is intercut with ads every 30 minutes or so. And as you say, not listening to an album all the way through, Matt, is a sign of madness. You listen to it in order, tracks 1 to 11.
Exactly.
No messing. Mm-hmm.
But that's right. The thing, a lot of artists make these albums, certainly the older versions. I mean, you go back to the Beatles and those sorts of groups. They made albums and they put them in a certain order because the songs needed to be listened to in that order.
Yeah, and the point you made about Drake is interesting as well, because we're now in this era of bands doing exclusive deals with rival streaming companies. So Tidal was an attempt by recording artists to take on Spotify and kind of reclaim the ground that they lost to it. It's not gone particularly well. Apple Music is Apple's slightly late entry into trying to take on Spotify after early success with iTunes. And we've had Microsoft, which has failed with Zune, and all these other services come and go. And it starts to get a bit confusing, right? You want to listen to all the music, but some of it's on this one, some of it's on Google, some of it's on Tidal, and it becomes quite confusing.
I think Spotify would probably carry on developing the way that it does. I mean, even Spotify CEO came out, as only a week or so ago, I think it was, and said that they've actually seen an increase in subscribers since Apple Music launched, rather than a decrease.
Because it's raised awareness.
Because it's raised awareness of music streaming, exactly.
Whoops. Moving on. Matt Reynolds, da 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 da, or da da da,
da da da.
Go on.
That's how it's pronounced. Yeah. So this is the really, you know, you think if you're the CEO of a social network that has a billion users worldwide, talking about Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook CEO, that you could think of something more inventive for your password than da da da, no capital letters. You know, the A's aren't fours, no exclamation mark. That was his password.
Apparently, that was his password, we should say.
That was the alleged password that he used for his Twitter, LinkedIn and Instagram, according to a hack that happened earlier this week.
Yeah, so the reason that is known to be allegedly his password, as you say, is because some of Mark Zuckerberg's social media accounts, not his Facebook account, were compromised by hackers. So what accounts got done?
So it was his Twitter, LinkedIn and Pinterest accounts that were hacked and had the password leaked. And this stems back from the 2012 LinkedIn hack, over 100...
Which got most of us.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Wired covered a story where you can check if it did get you indeed. You can put your details in and it's like, oh yeah, me too. So over 160 million user details and passwords were leaked. And it turns out that this da 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 password was lurking among there. And that apparently some, you know, slightly inventive hacker said, let's try it with Mark Zuckerberg's Twitter. And it turned out they logged in.
Yeah, and this might be quite typical of a lot of people. You go online and you set up an account for what looks like it's going to be the next big thing, which Zuckerberg did for Twitter. But he hasn't actually used the account since 2012.
Yeah, he's only tweeted a handful of times. It was back in 2012.
Because he's all about Facebook.
Exactly. No blue tick, which is a bit of a statement. He does have over 400,000 followers, but I think...
See, I would have thought it would be more.
Well, I think that, you know...
Even though he never tweets.
For me personally, you go on a Twitter account, and if they haven't tweeted in the last kind of, year or so, you think, oh, well, I'm not going to have a... You've got to keep the ratio right with followers to following, so can't be wasting them, can you?
Yep. So what happened after this hack? Did something appear on Mark Zuckerberg's Twitter account, or...?
Yeah, exactly. So this Twitter group, Our Mind, basically tweeted using Mark Zuckerberg's account. They essentially said, Mark... We've hacked your account. You know, we don't want to do anything wrong. Do you want to DM us? And Mark Zuckerberg tweeted back to him saying, no, you haven't. Though it was seemingly quite apparent that they actually had hacked him. And again, they did the same thing on Pinterest, basically saying, you've been hacked by Our Mind. So it was all very, reasonably low level, pretty nice, really. Just drawing attention to how bad his security had been. You know, the big... backlash for Our Mind is their Twitter account very quickly went offline, and Mark Zuckerberg recovered these accounts with pretty much no damage really being done to him.
But it just goes to show that no matter who you are, pick better passwords.
Yeah, not
even
da,
if you're
da,
Mark
da.
Zuckerberg. Da da da.
But even there was some I can't remember who published a report, but security experts have been saying for ages that like, you should never write your passwords down, store them digitally, store them in passwords managers. But then another report came out and said the chances of someone stealing a password from your person that you've written down is a lot lower than someone hacking into a password manager. So maybe writing it down is safer. I mean, I use password managers, so I'm not going to start saying that I write all my passwords down. But it's an interesting thing to think about.
All mine are tattooed on my feet. Because no one ever sees my feet. It's a safe place. This isn't the only security story that we've had this week, is it, Vicky?
Well, it appears that whether it's come from the Mark Zuckerberg hack or whether it was doing the rounds anyway, it appears that both Facebook and Netflix have started resetting passwords as a precaution. So Facebook, a number of Facebook users are reporting that they're getting this little error message. And I'll be honest, it sounds like a phishing message when it first appears. But it basically says there's a recent security incident on another website unrelated to Facebook, just to drive that point home. Facebook was not directly affected, but your Facebook account is at risk because you were using the same password in both places.
So this is an email that a good number of Facebook users been getting.
This is a warning message that comes up when these people sign in.
Right.
So then they can't actually access their account until they have changed their password.
Hmm.
Netflix is taking a slightly different tact and they're sending an email, a very similar sort of thing. They're saying, we believe your Netflix account credentials may have been included in a recent release of email addresses from an older breach at another company. Now, to be clear, neither site has been hacked, or not that we know of, or that they're aware of, or they're telling us. But they also don't explicitly mention which older breach they're protecting people from, but it is quite likely that it's the same LinkedIn one.
Yeah, and I found this kind of unhelpful. So if you get this email from Netflix or this message from Facebook saying, oh, you might have been compromised and it might have been an older attack, but we're not going to tell you if you were or not, or what attack it was.
But change your password anyway, you need to go and sort it out.
So then what do you do with that information? So yeah, sure, you change your Netflix or Facebook password, but was it from Tumblr? Was it from LinkedIn? Was it from Sony? Was it from TalkTalk? Was it from God knows where?
Yeah, I think there should be a little bit more kind of transparency around this. It's quite interesting to think, is this a hunch? Is it definitely my email? How do they know I'm using the same email on my Twitter and my Netflix? I think that's a really interesting one. You know, how can you guess that we've got this? What kind of information sharing is going on behind the scenes that leads them to be aware of this? I think with all these things, there just needs to be a little bit more, you know, transparency about why we're being told these things and what can we practically do. Is it different website? Different password per website? Is it password managers? Is it writing on your forehead? You know,
tattooing on your feet? But maybe there's a legal issue here. Maybe Netflix and Facebook don't want to allege against other companies being attacked and drag their name through the mud. Vicky, there was one other security
story.
This week.
Yep. This time it affected Twitter. So similar to the Facebook and Netflix emails and messages, Twitter hasn't necessarily been hacked itself, and this Twitter spokesperson has been very adamant that we are confident we haven't been breached. We are checking all the data, but we're pretty sure that actually this information has been taken from somewhere else. But there are reports that 32 million Twitter passwords have been stolen, and they were given to a site called LeakSource. According to reports, the majority were Russian, and it's not clear yet where they came from. But because they were written in plain text rather than being encrypted, and a lot of the social networks now will encrypt your password as a default, it's believed that maybe some sort of malware was running on the browser of the people who were affected by this.
And Twitter's going to cross-check the data and make sure that there's nothing in there, and I guess they'll be making a further statement. But it just goes to show that seemingly at the moment we're in a bit of a weird patch where a week doesn't go by without there being quite a major data breach story involving really, really big websites, and in the case of Mark Zuckerberg, a really, really big figure in the tech industry.
Well, hopefully it just brings the whole security issue to the fore. I mean, when you've got sites like Adobe being hacked, and don't get me wrong, huge amounts of people have Adobe accounts, but it's not until you are really targeting the 1 billion Facebook users and saying, look, there might be a security issue here, that people start thinking about it. And I mean, loads of companies, after the Apple iCloud hack, that they introduced two-factor authentication, and although that might seem a bit of a chore having to get a code on your phone, it then even if someone does steal your password, at least it wipes that out a little bit.
It's a really good idea. I definitely recommend doing it. Still to come, how do you fancy your chances of escaping a black hole? A new theory from Stephen Hawking and colleagues at Cambridge University could go a long way to solving one of the most head-scratchingly paradoxy paradoxes in physics. What happens to information that vanishes beyond the event horizon of a black hole.
By next year, maybe even next week, there could be a whole new way to pay. Maybe it'll be the next Bitcoin or the next Apple Pay, or maybe even both. Fortunately, Braintree's full-stack payment platform is easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily too. Accept everything from pounds to PayPal to that next big innovation, from any device with just one integration. And when that new payment method comes out, all you'll have to do is update a few lines of code. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree is here to help. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/wide news.
Welcome back. Before we get into a major new theory from Stephen Hawking, Vicky, there's some amazing new direct evidence of black holes devouring giant clouds of gas.
Yeah, quite. Yes, quite. I think the research is even referred to as a feeding frenzy. So astronomers from Cardiff and Yale universities have teamed up, and they have spotted the first direct evidence of black holes devouring cold, clumpy clouds of gas. So they were studying data from the ALMA telescope, looking to see how many stars were forming in a galaxy called Abel 2597. It's about a billion light years away. Now, stars typically form as cold gas collapses. But from this data, they noticed that the black hole at the heart of this galaxy was actually feeding on three clouds of this kind of cold gas.
So, sounds pretty remarkable. How can they actually know that this is what's happening?
So, first of all, they spotted the shadows of these gas clouds. And they noticed they were cast against these huge, bright jets of material spewing from the centre of the black hole. Now, this contrast suggested that these clouds were very close to the black hole and in danger of being consumed by it. By measuring the light from these jets, the astronomers were able to not only determine that the gas was in danger, but also that they were speeding towards the supermassive black hole at a staggering 800,000 miles per hour.
I like the idea that gas could be in danger. There's this lurking black hole.
So there's some pretty big numbers, but why is this significant and why should I care about this?
So before, astronomers always thought the supermassive black holes grew gradually. By almost grazing in the same way we do with a snack over 11's ears, then they would graze on this hot gas moving sort of smoothly into the abyss. But these observations suggest that occasionally these black holes devour fast-moving cold gas much more chaotically.
And what does this have any kind of practical implications? What can we actually learn from this?
Well, the observations also gave a sort of cosmic weather report. So it showed that hot gas sort of streams into the black hole at a low level pretty much constantly. This then causes rainstorms. These storms release droplets of cold gas, and for a very short amount of time, the black hole eats very quickly. And this suggests there are two dinner modes for black holes, in the same way that we would, if we're a bit hungry, we might devour something really quickly, or if we're a bit full, we might pick at our food. And what's interesting about that is that it, going on to what we're going to talk about in a second about Stephen Hawking's theory, is it just gives us more of an insight into how black holes behave. There's lots of different theories about, are there wormholes in black holes, or are the universes on the other side? So the more we know about black holes, the more we can rule out some of these crazier theories and maybe confirm some of the more rational ones.
So to rewind just a little bit, Matt Reynolds, you've been compiling some sort of good answers to basic questions that people might have about black holes. Let's start with the really basic one. What is a black hole?
Great question, James.
Thanks.
So essentially, a black hole is a place where gravity is so strong that it pulls everything towards it that not even light can get out. So essentially, to escape from a black hole, you'd need to be moving faster than the speed of light. To escape its gravity, you can't move faster than the speed of light. I'll just give you a bit more detail and say they're made essentially where very huge stars collapse, and huge stars have got a great amount of mass to them. They die and they collapse in on themselves, and this basically concentrates lots and lots and lots of mass into one tiny, tiny point. And that's what causes this, you know, massive gravitational pull.
Okay, and supermassive black holes are a whole different kettle of fish. These are vast, vast things.
Yeah, I mean, these things are massive. Scientists think, or they know actually, that there's a supermassive black hole at the centre of every single galaxy. So our friendly supermassive black hole is called Sagittarius A. That one in particular has a mass that's equal to about 4 million suns. And it's also several million times larger than the Earth. So this is huge, huge, and very, very dense thing.
Right. And the interesting thing about the story Vicky was talking through is we were able to not see the black hole, but we were able to see what it was doing to things nearby it. Why can't we see black holes? And don't say because they're black.
Yeah, they're really, really dark. So the problem is, you know, how seeing works essentially is that light bounces off a thing and it bounces into our eyes or our telescope or onto our camera lens, and that's what enables us to see. So, you know, seeing is all about light bouncing off things into receptors. But because black holes absorb any light that goes past, it's impossible to actually see them. However, what we can do, and what Vicky was talking about, is that we can kind of see black holes by looking at how they interact with other things around them. So, for instance, we know when black holes are passing by stars because there's a kind of high energy light that this interaction produces. So although we can't see the black hole itself, we can see the trace of its impact on other things it's moving around.
It's crazy. At that point, let's jump on to Stephen Hawking's latest theory, which I've been trying to get my head around over the last few days. So Stephen Hawking has suggested that black holes aren't the eternal prisons of doom that we all thought they were, and that you could, in theory, escape them, sort of. So the theory attempts to solve the black hole information paradox, which states that anything, you, a planet, light, a donkey, anything, crossing the event horizon of a black hole would be lost forever. The black hole information paradox, that black holes simultaneously erase information and retain it, goes right back to the theory of relativity. But Hawking and colleagues at Cambridge University think they've cracked it. Their solution to the paradox suggests that black holes have soft hair. Yes, that's right.
Very
soft
romantic.
Hair. Yes, to go with their strange appetites and feeding habits. Or low-energy quantum excitations that release information when a black hole evaporates.
You can see why they called it soft hair.
Yes, and it's called soft hair because if you think about it, it almost looks like hair. So if you imagine things going into a black hole as very long tubes or straws or bits of hay, something like that, and everything will be disappearing into the black hole and you'll be able to see the ends of these bits of straw. And at that point, the information that was on those straws as they went in are retained on the outside, whereas everything that goes in disappears. But there is a permanent record because you can, in effect, see the pattern of it disappearing into the black hole on the event horizon. And it's there that information is stored forever. A bit like, I don't know, if I have mucky hands right now and I have to put them on the wall, I take my hand away, but you can still see my fingerprints, even though my hand is now invisible to you. That's probably a terrible analogy, but that's kind of how it feels to me, that there's this print almost left behind.
But is it destroyed when it goes inside the black hole? Or does it whirl around forever like a kind of, you know, space bathtub?
Well, this is the problem, because black holes can vanish. They can disappear. But the information wouldn't be lost because it would be retained in this signature. And this is where it gets a bit confusing. So in the 1970s, Hawking suggested that when a particle-antiparticle pair are sucked into a black hole, one particle radiates away into space, taking energy from the black hole with it. This, in turn, means a black hole can disappear because it's losing mass, but it's already taken all of the information inside it. And you can't lose information. That's absolutely impossible. So the idea that data can be erased goes against the fundamental part of modern physics, that it's possible to reverse time. So if you could, you can reverse time. And this is what happens when we look very, very deep into space. We're seeing back in time. So if you run a film of the universe backwards, you should be able to see the collapse of a dead star into a black hole. But if the black hole took that information with it when it collapsed, that information would no longer exist. It would have never existed. You can't delete information, which means that you can't see the collision of a star and a black hole, but you can.
And that's the paradox.
That's the paradox. Matt, you're blinking very slowly.
And it's got something to do with soft hair.
Yes. So the soft hair that Hawking, and it's probably unhelpful to think of it as hair. It's not hair. Black holes are not hairy. So the soft hair that Hawking proposes stores this lost information. So this means that the information has a signature or a record. So the black hole is a record of everything that it swallows in some way. So even after the hole has disappeared, there is a signature of the information that it took with it. So if you think of something sliding into a black hole, its passage into the black hole, as I said, a bit like with fingerprints or with looking at one end of a piece of straw, would remain. So it would leave a pattern on the event horizon of a black hole, the point at which everything that falls in is doomed. This would, Hawking argues, leave a halo of, as they refer to it, soft hair. And these patterns would contain the information about anything that has passed into a black hole and disappeared, We should say that others working in the field have pointed out that Hawking's theory doesn't fully solve the mind-bending paradox, because these things take time. Physicist Gary Horovitz argued that it was unclear whether all the information could be transferred to the soft hair, but added it was certainly possible that further investigation would uncover more hair of this type, which could in turn resolve the black hole information paradox. Matt, to go back to you, are black holes portals to another universe?
Almost definitely. No, we're not quite sure if black holes are portals to another universe. And the reason being, a portal to another universe would be something called a wormhole. And it'd be really, really difficult to actually distinguish between a black hole and a wormhole. So essentially, the reason why scientists think that wormholes might exist, essentially, is if you imagine the universe as a kind of 2D plane, so a flat piece of paper, and you imagine a black hole is sucking things in, you know, imagine a little hole in that paper and stuff kind of dripping along the paper and into that hole. Now, if you imagine another universe, another sheet of paper underneath it, that if that hole led to that next sheet of paper, that would mean that black hole wasn't actually leading to nowhere and just gobbling it up. It was actually taking you to the next universe.
What does that mean for the hair?
Well, yeah, I'm not really sure about this soft hair, because, you know, essentially if that soft hair is kind of hanging around there, I'm not sure if this means that a door closes up between universes that means you can't kind of get back between. What I do know, however, is that if you somehow manage to, you know, survive the really, really difficult physical conditions of falling into a wormhole, it's not like you'd be, oh, great, I'm in a different universe, this is really cool, I'll kind of, you know, fly about. For a start, it'd take like a billion years to go between the two as you're sucked between them. But then probably what would happen is, because the gravity is so strong at either end of the wormhole, you'd be sucked back in from the other end of the wormhole into a kind of perpetual yo-yo motion, unless for some reason you had a spacecraft that could go faster than the speed of light and then could break out. So really, you know, it sounds like a great inter-universe adventure, but it's just, you know, stuck on the same train going back and forth forever.
Kind of like the DLR.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. Yeah, it is a DLR is a wormhole.
Or a stellar hyperloop.
Yeah,
for our international listeners, the DLR is a light railway system in East London that is impossible to navigate and you seem to get lost on forever. Or I do, because I don't live in East London. So there we go. I think what this goes back to is, it's fascinating how much more we now know about black holes, that people, incredibly intelligent people like Stephen Hawking and his colleagues at Cambridge, are able to come up with these theories, and that they start to make sense of what were, until quite recently, almost completely unexplainable phenomena in the universe. And it's really a remarkable time for space and science, and I think we're all kind of space geeks, so it's been really good fun talking about this, but also spending most of the week reading about it and scratching my head. It's a fun hobby.
It also amazes me that Stephen Hawking, one of the greatest minds of our generation, potentially will never win a Nobel Prize, because all of these amazing theories that he has, he can't prove them, or not yet, anyway.
Yes, and it's the sort of work that might take a few people's lifetimes, and eventually there'll be someone that will build on all of this and come up with something that helps to explain all of these unexplainables. We'll leave it at that. Go and cool down your brains. Thanks very much for listening. We will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.